I'm reading today from Auguste Comte's Introduction to Positive Philosophy, Chapter 1, The Nature and Importance of the Positive Philosophy. In order to explain properly the true nature and peculiar character of the positive philosophy, it is indispensable that we should first take a brief survey of the progressive growth of the human mind viewed as a whole. For no idea can be properly understood apart from its history. In thus studying the total development of human intelligence in its different spheres of activity, from its first and simplest beginning up to our own time, I believe that I have discovered a great fundamental law, to which the mind is subjected by an invariable necessity. The truth of this law can, I think, be demonstrated both by reasoned proofs, furnished by a knowledge of our mental organization, and by historical verification due to an attentive study of the past. This law consists in the fact that each of our principal conceptions, each branch of our knowledge, passes in succession through three different theoretical states: the theological or fictitious, the metaphysical or abstract state, and the scientific or positive state. In other words, the human mind, by its very nature, makes use successively in each of its researches of three methods of philosophizing, whose characters are essentially different and even radically opposed to each other. We have first the theological method, then the metaphysical method, and finally the positive method. Hence, there are three kinds of philosophy or general systems of conceptions on the aggregate of phenomena which are mutually exclusive of each other. The first is the necessary starting point of human intelligence. The third represents its fixed and definitive state. The second is destined to serve only as a transitional method. In the theological state, the human mind directs its researches mainly toward the inner nature of beings and toward the first and final causes of all phenomena that it observes. In a word, towards absolute knowledge. It therefore represents these phenomena as being produced by the direct and continuous action of more or less numerous supernatural agents whose arbitrary intervention explains all the apparent anomalies of the universe. In the metaphysical state, which is in reality only a simple general modification of the first state, the supernatural agents are replaced by abstract forces, real entities or personified abstractions, inherent in the different beings of the world. These entities are looked upon as capable of giving rise by themselves to all the phenomena observed, each phenomenon being explained by assigning it to its corresponding entity. Finally, in the positive state, the human mind, recognizing the impossibility of obtaining absolute truth, gives up the search after the origin and hidden causes of the universe and a knowledge of the final causes of phenomena. It endeavors now only to discover, by a well-combined use of reasoning and observation, the actual laws of phenomena, that is to say, their invariable relations of succession and likeness. The explanation of facts, thus reduced to its real terms, consists henceforth only in the connection established between different particular phenomena and some general facts, the number of which the progress of science tends more and more to diminish. The theological system arrived at its highest form of perfection when it substituted the providential action of a single being for the varied play of the numerous independent gods which had been imagined by the primitive mind. In the same way, the last stage of the metaphysical system consisted in replacing the different special entities by the idea of a single great general entity, nature, looked upon as the sole source of all phenomena. Similarly, the ideal of the positive system, toward which it constantly tends, although in all probability it will never attain such a stage, would be reached if we could look upon all the different phenomena observable as so many particular cases of a single general fact, such as that of gravitation, for example. This is not the place to give a special demonstration of this fundamental law of mental development, and to deduce from it its most important consequences. We shall make a direct study of it, with all the necessary details, in the part of the work relating to social phenomena. I am considering it now only in order to determine precisely the true character of the positive philosophy, as opposed to the two other philosophies which have successively dominated our whole intellectual system up to these latter centuries. For the present, to avoid leaving entirely undemonstrated so important a law, the applications of which frequently occur throughout this work, I must confine myself to a rapid enumeration of the most evident general reasons that prove its exactitude. In the first place, it is, I think, sufficient merely to enunciate such a law for its accuracy to be immediately verified by all those who are fairly well acquainted with the general history of the sciences, for there is not a single science that has today reached the positive stage which was not in the past, as each can see easily for himself, composed mainly of metaphysical abstractions, and going back further still, it was altogether under the sway of theological conception. Unfortunately, we shall have to recognize on more than one occasion, in the different parts of this course, that even the most perfect sciences retain today some very evident traces of these two primitive stages. This general revolution of the human mind can, moreover, be easily verified today in a very obvious, although indirect manner, if we consider the development of the individual intelligence. The starting point being necessarily the same in the education of the individual as in that of the race, the various principal phases of the former must reproduce the fundamental epochs of the latter. Now, does not each of us, in contemplating his own history, recollect that he has been successively, as regards most important ideas, a theologian in childhood, a metaphysician in youth, and a natural philosopher in manhood? This verification of the law can easily be made by all those who are on a level with their era. But, in addition to the proofs of the truth of this law furnished by direct observation of the race or the individual, I must, above all, mention in this brief summary the theoretical considerations that show its necessity. The most important of these considerations arises from the very nature of the subject itself. It consists in the need at every epoch of having some theory to connect the facts, while on the other hand, it was clearly impossible for the primitive human mind to form theories based on observation. All competent thinkers agree with Bacon that there can be no real knowledge except that which rests upon observed facts. This fundamental maxim is evidently indisputable if it is applied, as it ought to be, to the mature state of our intelligence. But if we consider the origin of our knowledge, it is no less certain that the primitive human mind could not, and indeed ought not, to have thought in that way. For if, on the one hand, every positive theory must necessarily be founded upon observation, it is, on the other hand, no less true that, in order to observe, our mind has need of some theory or other. If, in contemplating phenomena, we did not immediately connect them with some principles, not only would it be impossible for us to combine these isolated observations and, therefore, to derive any profit from them, but we should even be entirely incapable of remembering the facts, which would, for the most part, remain unnoted by us. Thus, there were two difficulties to be overcome. The human mind had to observe in order to form real theories. And yet it had to form theories of some sort before it could apply itself to a connected series of observation. The primitive human mind, therefore, found itself involved in a vicious cycle, from which it would never have had any means of escaping if a natural way out of the difficulty had not fortunately been found by the spontaneous development of theological conception. These presented a rallying point for the efforts of the mind and furnished materials for its activity. This is the fundamental motive which demonstrates the logical necessity for the purely theological character of primitive philosophy, apart from those important social considerations relating to the matter which I cannot even indicate now. This necessity becomes still more evident when we regard the perfect congruity of theological philosophy with the peculiar nature of the researches on which the human mind in its infancy concentrated to so high a degree all its efforts. It is indeed very noticeable that the most insoluble questions, such as the inner nature of objects, or the origin and purpose of all phenomena, are precisely those which the human mind proposes to itself, in preference to all others, in its primitive state, all real soluble problems being looked upon as hardly worthy of serious thought. The reason for this is very obvious, since it is experience alone that has enabled us to estimate our abilities rightly. And if man had not commenced by overestimating his forces, these would never have been able to acquire all the development of which they are capable. This fact is a necessity of our organization. But be that as it may, let us picture to ourselves, as far as we are able, this early mental disposition, so universal and so prominent, and let us ask ourselves what kind of reception would have been accorded at such an epoch to the positive philosophy. Supposing it to have been then formed, the highest ambition of this philosophy is to discover the laws of phenomena, and its characteristic is precisely that of regarding as necessarily interdicted to the human reason all those sublime mysteries which theological philosophy, on the contrary, explains with such admirable facility, even to the smallest detail. Under such circumstances, it's easy to see what choice the primitive man would make. The same thing is true when we consider from a practical standpoint the nature of the pursuits with which the human mind first occupies itself. Under that aspect, they offer to man the strong attraction of an unlimited control over the exterior world, which is regarded as being entirely destined for our use, while all its phenomena seem to have close and continuous relations with our existence. These chimerical hopes, these exaggerated ideas of man's importance in the universe to which the theological philosophy gives rise, are destroyed irrevocably by the first fruits of the positive philosophy. But at the beginning, they afforded an indispensable stimulus, without the aid of which we cannot indeed conceive how the primitive mind would have been induced to undertake any arduous labors. We are at the present time so far removed from that early state of mind, at least as regards the majority of phenomena, that it is difficult for us to appreciate properly the force and necessity of such consideration. Human reason is now so mature that we are able to undertake laborious scientific researches without having in view any extraneous goal capable of strongly exciting the imagination, such as that of which the astrologers or alchemists proposed to themselves. Our intellectual activity is sufficiently excited by the mere hope of discovering the laws of phenomena, by the simple desire of verifying or disproving a theory. This, however, could not be the case in the infancy of the human mind. Without the attractive chimeras of astrology or the powerful deceptions of alchemy, for example, where should we have found the perseverance and ardor necessary for collecting the long series of observations and experiments, which later on served as the basis for the first positive theories of these two classes of phenomena? The need for such a stimulus to our intellectual development was keenly felt long ago by Kepler in the case of astronomy, and has been justly appreciated in our own time by Berthelet in chemistry. The above considerations show us that, although the positive philosophy represents the true final state of human intelligence, that to which it has always tended more and more, it was nonetheless necessary to employ the theological philosophy at first, and during many centuries, both as a method and as furnishing provisional doctrine. Because the theological philosophy was spontaneous in its character, it was the only one possible in the beginning. It was also the only one to offer a sufficient interest to our budding intelligence. It is now very easy to see that, in order to pass from this provisional form of philosophy to the final stage, the human mind was naturally obliged to adopt metaphysical methods and doctrines as a transitional form of philosophy. This last consideration is indispensable in order to complete the general sketch of the great law which I have pointed out. It is easily seen that our understanding, which was compelled to progress by almost insensible steps, could not pass suddenly and without any intermediate stages from theological to positive philosophy. Theology and physics are so profoundly incompatible, their conceptions are so radically opposed in character, that before giving up the one in order to employ the other exclusively, the human intelligence had to make use of intermediate conceptions, which, being of a hybrid character, were eminently fitted to bring about this gradual transition. That is the part played by metaphysical conceptions, and they have no other real use. by substituting in the study of phenomena a corresponding inseparable entity for a direct supernatural agency. Although at first the former was only held to be an offshoot of the latter, man gradually accustomed himself to consider only the facts themselves. This development was caused by the concepts of metaphysical agents gradually becoming so empty through over-subtle qualification that all right-minded persons considered them to be only the abstract names of the phenomena in question. It is impossible to imagine by what other method our understanding could have passed from frankly supernatural to purely natural considerations, or in other words, from the theological to the positive regime. I have thus established, insofar as it is possible without entering into a special discussion, which would be out of place at the present moment, that which I conceive to be the general law of mental development. It will now be easy for us to determine precisely the exact nature of the positive philosophy. To do that is the special object of this chapter. We have seen that the fundamental character of the positive philosophy is to consider all phenomena as subject to invariable natural laws. The exact discovery of these laws and their reduction to the least possible number constitute the goal of all our effort, for we regard the search after what are called causes, whether first or final, as absolutely inaccessible and unmeaning. It is unnecessary to dwell much on a principle that has now become so familiar to all who have made anything like a serious study of the observational sciences. Everybody, indeed, knows that in our positive explanations, even when they are most complete, we do not pretend to explain the real causes of phenomena, as this would merely throw the difficulty further back. We try only to analyze correctly the circumstances of their production, and to connect them by normal relations of succession and similarity. Thus, to cite the best example, we say that the general phenomena of the universe are explained, as far as they can be, by the Newtonian law of gravitation. On the one hand, this admirable theory shows us all the immense variety of astronomical facts as only a single fact looked at from different points of view. That fact being that the constant tendency of all molecules toward each other in direct proportion to their masses and inversely as the squares of their distance. On the other hand, this general fact is shown to be the simple extension of an extremely familiar and well-known phenomenon, the weight of a body at the Earth's surface. As to determining what attraction and weight are in themselves, or what their causes are, these are questions which we regard as insoluble and outside the domain of the positive philosophy. We therefore rightly abandon them to the imagination of the theologians or the subtleties of the metaphysician. That it is clearly impossible to solve such questions is shown by the fact that whenever an attempt has been made to give a rational explanation of the matter, the greatest thinkers have only been able to define one of these principles by the other. Attraction is defined as nothing but universal weight, and weight is said to consist simply in terrestrial attraction. Explanations of this kind raise a smile if put forth as furnishing us with a knowledge of quote-unquote things in themselves and the mode of causation of phenomena. They are, however, the only satisfactory results obtainable, for they present as identical two orders of phenomena which for so long a time were regarded as unconnected. No sensible person would nowadays seek to go beyond this. It would be easy to multiply these examples, which will occur very frequently throughout this treatise, for at the present day all great intellectual operations are conducted in this spirit. To take a single example of this from contemporary works, I will choose the fine series of researches made by Fourier on the theory of heat. This affords us an excellent verification of the preceding general remarks. In this work, the philosophical character of which is so eminently positive, the most important and most precise laws of thermal phenomena are disclosed. But the author has not inquired into the intimate nature of heat itself, nor, as he mentioned, except to point out its uselessness. The vigorous controversy between the partisans of heat as a material substance and those who make it consist in the vibrations of a universal ether. Yet, that work treats of the most important questions, several of which had never been raised, a clear proof that the human mind, by simply confining itself to researches of an entirely positive order, can find therein inexhaustible food for its highest form of activity without attacking inaccessible problems. Having thus indicated, insofar as it was possible in this general sketch, the spirit of the positive philosophy, which the whole of this course is intended to develop, we must next consider what stage in the formation of that philosophy has now been reached, and what remains to be done in order to constitute it fully. I'm gonna skip a little. Does the positive philosophy, which during the last two centuries has gradually acquired so great an extension, embrace at the present day all classes of phenomena? It is evident that it does not. Therefore, a great scientific work still remains to be executed in order to give the positive philosophy that universal character indispensable for its final constitution. In the four principal categories of natural phenomena enumerated above, astronomical, physical, chemical, and physiological, we note an important omission relating to social phenomena. Although these are implicitly comprised among physiological phenomena, yet owing to their importance and the inherent difficulties of their study, they deserve to form a distinct class. This last order of ideas is concerned with the most special, most complicated, and most dependent of all phenomena. It has, therefore, necessarily progressed more slowly than all the preceding orders, even if we do not take into account the more special obstacles to its study, which we shall consider later on. However that may be, it is evident that it has not yet been included within the domain of positive philosophy. Theological and metaphysical methods are never used now by anyone dealing with all the other kinds of phenomena, either as a means of investigation or even a mode of reasoning. But these discarded methods are, on the contrary, still used exclusively for both purposes in everything that concerns social phenomena, although their insufficiency in this respect has been fully felt already by all the good minds. Such men being tired of these empty and endless discussions between, for example, divine right and the sovereignty of people. Here, then, is the great, but evidently the only gap that has to be filled in order to finish the construction of the positive philosophy. Now that the human mind has found celestial physics, terrestrial physics, and organic physics, it only remains to complete the system of observational sciences by the foundation of social physics. This is, at the present time, under several important aspects, the greatest and most pressing of our cognitive needs, and to meet this need is, I may be bold to say, the first purpose of this work, its special object. And I'm going to skip to the end of the chapter. To sum up the matter, the theological and metaphysical philosophies are now disputing with each other the task of reorganizing society, although that task is really too hard for their united efforts. It is between these schools only that any struggle still exists in this respect. The positive philosophy has, up to the present, intervened in the contest only in order to criticize both schools, and it has accomplished this task so well as to discredit them entirely. Let us put it in a condition to play an active part without paying any further attention to debates that have become useless. We must complete the vast intellectual operation commenced by Bacon, Descartes, and Galileo by furnishing the positive philosophy with the system of general ideas that is destined to prevail henceforth and for an indefinite future amongst the human race. The revolutionary crisis which harasses civilized peoples will then be at an end. Such are the four principal advantages that will follow from the establishment of the positive philosophy. I have thought it well to mention them at once because they supplement the general definition that I have tried to give of it. Before concluding, I desire to caution the reader briefly against an erroneous anticipation which he might form as to the nature of the present work. In saying that the aim of the positive philosophy was to sum up in a single body of homogeneous doctrine the aggregate of acquired knowledge relating to the different orders of natural phenomena, I did not mean that we should proceed to the general study of these phenomena by looking upon them as so many different effects of a single principle as reducible to one sole law. Although I must treat this question specially in the next chapter, I think it necessary to say so much at once in order to avoid unfounded objections that might otherwise be raised. I refer to those critics who might jump to the conclusion that this course is one of those attempts at universal explanation by a single law, which one sees made daily by men who are entire strangers to scientific methods and knowledge. Nothing of the kind is intended here, and the development of this course will furnish the best proof of it to all those whom the explanations contained in this chapter might have left in any doubt on the subject. It is my deep personal conviction that these attempts at the universal explanation of all phenomena by a single law are highly chimerical, even when they are made by the most competent minds. I believe that the resources of the human mind are too feeble, and the universe is too complicated to admit of our ever attaining such scientific perfection. And I also think that a very exaggerated idea is generally formed of the advantages to be derived from it, even were they attainable. In any case, it seems to me evident that, considering the present state of our knowledge, we are yet a long way from the time when any such attempt might reasonably be expected to succeed. It seems to me that we could hope to arrive at it only by connecting all natural phenomena with the most general positive law with which we are acquainted, the law of gravitation, which already links all astronomical phenomena to some of the phenomena of terrestrial physics. Laplace has effectively brought forward a conception by which chemical phenomena would be regarded as purely simple molecular effects of Newtonian attraction, modified by the figure and mutual position of the atoms. This conception would probably always remain an open question, owing to the absence of any essential data respecting the intimate constitution of bodies, and it is almost certain that the difficulty of applying the idea would be so great that we should still be obliged to retain, as an artificial aid, the division which at present is regarded as natural between astronomy and chemistry. Accordingly, Laplace only presented his idea as a mere philosophical game, which is incapable of really exercising any useful influence on the progress of chemical science. The case is really stronger, however, for even if we supposed this insurmountable difficulty overcome, we should still not have attained scientific unity, since it would be necessary next to connect the same law of gravitation with the whole of physiology, and this would certainly not be the least difficult part of the task. Yet the hypothesis which we have been just discussing would be on the whole the most favorable to this much desired unity. I have no need to go further into details in order to convince the reader that the object of this course is by no means to present all natural phenomena as being at bottom identical, apart from the variety of circumstances. The positive philosophy would no doubt be more perfect if this were possible, but the condition is not at all necessary either for its systematic formulation or for the realization of the great and happy consequences which we have seen it is destined to produce. The only indispensable unity for those purposes is that of method, which can and evidently must be and is already largely established. As to the scientific product, it is not necessary that it should be unified. It is sufficient that if it be homogeneous. What? It is therefore from the double standpoint of unity of method and homogeneity of scientific propositions that the different classes of positive theories will be considered in the present work. While trying to diminish as far as possible the number of general laws necessary for the positive explanation of natural phenomena, which is the real philosophic purpose of all science, we shall think it rash ever to hope, even in the most distant future, to reduce these laws rigorously to a single one. I have attempted in this chapter to determine, as exactly as I could, the aim, the spirit, and the influence of the positive philosophy. I have therefore indicated the goal which my labors have always tended, and always will tend unceasingly in this course or elsewhere. No one is more profoundly convinced than myself of the inadequacy of my intellectual powers, even if they were far superior to what they are, to undertake such a vast and noble work. But although the task is too great for a single mind or a single lifetime, yet one man can state the problem clearly, and this is all I am ambitious of. Having thus expounded the true aim of this course, by setting the point of view from which I shall consider the various principal branches of natural philosophy, I shall in the next chapter complete these general preliminaries by explaining the plan I have adopted, that is to say, by determining the encyclopedic order that should be established amongst the general classes of natural phenomena, and consequently among the corresponding positive science. And there's just one more 30-page section called The Classification of the Positives, which I will not read here.